You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Farad. Coming up, a summer camp at Madison College offers teen girls the chance to learn how to use power tools. We'll hear about the goals of that program.
Now, for the first time, it looks like women will finally have a new place in everyday American life, on the money.
The Treasury Department will announce today that Harriet Tubman, an abolitionist who helped hundreds of slaves to freedom, is to replace former president and slaveholder Andrew Jackson on the front of the $20 bill. Jackson will move to the back of the bill.
The $20 bill isn't all that's changing. The $10 bill will also see some changes and will still feature the man who inspired this Broadway show. Alexander Hamilton, as they're singing, he'll be joined by leaders of the women's suffrage movement on the $10 note. Here to tell us more about the change is Anna Swanson. She's a reporter for the Washington Post's Wonk blog, and her article on the currency change is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Anna, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So other than the fact that these new people will be on bills or people are moving around on the bills, what do we know about how our new $10 and $20 bills might look in the next few years?
Well, it's actually changes to three bills that were announced today, the 5, the 10, and the 20. And there's really a slew of changes, a lot more faces being added, some scenes from history being added to the bills as well, in order to, you know, add the faces of women who are not currently represented on the paper currency of the U.S., as well as the contributions of minorities to American history.
So there has been a movement for a while to get a woman or women onto American currency. Give us a sense of how that started. Where did that come from?
Well, there was a viral movement starting a few years ago to put a woman on the $20 bill in 2020 in time for the 100th anniversary of a woman's right to vote. And that's something that, you know, sprang up online. It was promoted by an organization called Women for 20s. And that organization got hundreds of thousands of people to vote on which of 15 women from American history should grace the front of a bill. And those votes actually ended up choosing Harriet Tubman, who the Treasury Department has now announced will be on the face of the 20. After that, I think the Treasury Department realized how much popular support there was for this. So last summer, they announced that they would begin looking to put a woman on the bill, but that the next bill up for redesign was the $10 bill with Alexander Hamilton on it. And that's an announcement that sparked a lot of opposition from Hamilton fans, as you noted. So this has been kind of a long process of consideration getting to the announcement today.
So how often are there reconfigurations of our currency, and what's usually the motivation for doing that?
You know, not very often, and that's part of the reason why this has become such a high-profile decision. Some other countries really do reexamine and renew their currency more often and have more public figures on their currency. The U.S. hasn't done that as much. Right, the Treasury Department's first responsibility in reviewing the currency and, you know, their first priority in making these redesigns is security. So they're looking to protect the bill from counterfeiters. And that's why, you know, they initially looked at the $10 bill, which features Alexander Hamilton, because that's the bill that was up for the next redesign.
And so you said that Harriet Tubman got the most votes out of, I think you said, 15 women. Who are some of the other ones that were being suggested?
So there were a variety of women. Their final round candidates, in addition to Tubman, were Eleanor Roosevelt, Rosa Parks, and Wilma Mankiller. But there were others as well, including Betty Friedan, Sojourner Truth, Rachel Carson. So a variety of, you know, political figures, social figures, and also women who fought for women's right to vote as well.
So it's interesting because this change is putting an abolitionist, Harriet Tubman, on the front of a bill, moving former President Andrew Jackson to the back, who was a slaveholder. Was it necessary to keep Andrew Jackson on at all?
You know, I'm not sure about that. I think, you know, ultimately the Treasury felt that they still wanted to continue to honor that. In an announcement today, Jack Lew mentioned that there is a statue of Andrew Jackson outside of the Treasury. So I think they probably wanted to, you know, create some continuity with that old bill. So he will be moved to the back, and on the back of the bill, he'll still be featured there with the White House, which is currently on the back of that bill.
I think it's really interesting, too, Anna, that people are seeing this as a victory for women being put on paper currency, but also this is a person of color being put on paper currency. Is this the first time that a person of color has been on any kind of U.S. legal tender?
Well, so there are a few examples of Native Americans. There's the Sacagawea dollar coin. Also in the mid-1800s, Pocahontas was featured on a $20 note, which was a lot of money in the mid-1800s, so probably wasn't too common. But she actually wasn't portrayed in portrait style. She was, you know, pictured as part of a scene. But yes, I mean, this is certainly a very, you know, historic and momentous change.
We're talking with Anna Swanson. She's a reporter for the Washington Post's Wonk blog. And we're talking about the decision to put Harriet Tubman, the abolitionist, most famously associated with the Underground Railroad, on the United States $20 bill. Now, Anna, I'm assuming that changes like this, the decisions don't get made overnight, and the actual printing of the currency doesn't happen overnight either. When might we see, first of all, the mock-ups of these, and then when might they actually be in circulation?
Well, the Treasury Department announced today that they plan to release the designs for all of the bills by 2020, which, again, you know, that is the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage. And so they feel that it's, you know, an important symbolic gesture to release that design for the bill, having a woman on the $20 bill by that year. I don't think, unfortunately, they'll be able to release the bill into circulation by that year. They kind of were vague on that today, you know, saying Jack Lew, the Treasury Secretary, said that he had ordered the Bureau of Engraving to accelerate this process as much as possible, and that they were going to work on this as quickly as possible, but they didn't give a specific time frame.
Have you heard of any backlash to the proposed changes to the $5, $10, and $20 bills?
Well, I mean, there was certainly a lot of backlash to the idea of removing Alexander Hamilton, who, you know, has become a popular figure in pop culture with the new Broadway play all about his life. And, you know, I did hear a lot of opposition to removing him, in part because he really was the architect of our economic and banking system. He was the first Secretary of the Treasury, and so people felt that he held a very important symbolic role being pictured on the currency.
So Alexander Hamilton is holding his place on the $10 bill. Are people responding positively to having suffragists join him on that?
Yes. Yeah, I think so. I mean, the picture I've gotten from the new redesign is that it just features a lot more scenes and a lot more faces. So people are kind of in different combinations on all of the bills now. So, for example, the face of the new 10 still features Alexander Hamilton, but the back features a scene of a march for women's suffrage, and the Treasury Department said today it will honor suffrage movement leaders like Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and Sojourner Truth. And then the $5 bill, the back of that is going to honor the civil rights movement by showing the famous March on Washington and the steps of the Lincoln Memorial and the figures of Martin Luther King Jr., Eleanor Roosevelt, and Marian Anderson, the African-American opera singer who sang at the March on Washington.
Well, Anna, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Anna Swanson, reporter for the Washington Post's Wonk blog. She talked with us about plans to put the first woman on the $20 bill, abolitionist Harriet Tubman. Her article is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk about a new camp aimed at teaching teenage girls essential carpentry skills.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. We each have a unique story, but there are themes that reach across all human experience. Writer Deborah Monroe shares her earliest memory and the lessons of loss that mark all of our lives.
In my earliest memory, a memory of a day, then fainter, fainter, like a Xerox, a memory of memory, I sit on a blanket. I've not been a member of the human race long. Trees seem stunning, clustered emeralds on thick stems. I admire lilacs, too, lavender puff clouds. We're visiting my mother's widowed Aunt Edna, who lives with a spare female from her dead husband's clan, and my great-grandmother, who's gone around the bend, as I've just overheard during the car ride here. Then my mother, my great-aunt, and the spinster rush inside the house with its cupola, leaded glass in every window, a house that isn't historic yet, just 60 years old. A mausoleum, my mother might have said. Great-Aunt Edna swabs windows with sheets of newspaper and a solution made of vinegar, but my mother uses Windex and Procter & Gamble paper towels. Great-Aunt Edna's attic was once a maid's room, the narrow kitchen with its swinging door, the cook's domain. But there aren't maids and cooks in 1960. The women surge inside and leave me on my blanket and my great-grandmother in her chair. I grew up with a father, sister, and brother, too. My father must be in Spooner, Wisconsin, where we live. My sister has been swept along into the house. My brother isn't born, just a twinkling volition in the life before this, a fist-sized fetus in my mother's belly. Stranded with my great-grandmother, who starts to sob and call out, "Don't leave me," I know that the two of us, left to fend for ourselves, are doomed. I sob too. The women rush back out, great-Aunt Edna and the spinster soothing my great-grandmother, my mother swinging me into her arms. My sister, a novice, takes note. In a chorus of sighs, the kindred women tell my great-grandmother and me, "We will never leave you." In time, after whispered phone conversations, everyone did leave my great-grandmother. We visited her at the nursing home. I wore a dress one size smaller than my sister's, our haircuts, anklets, and shoes identical too. My brother trailed behind, sucking his thumb. The old people revived as we walked in. They wanted us, the children. Or, slumped in chairs, eyes gummy and haze, they wanted to be us. We didn't want them. "Gutta," a woman said, arms outstretched. It could have been gibberish, or some odd scrap of Czech or German. The nursing home seemed like the zoo, I decided, which we visited later that day. The zoo, where monkeys petted and slapped each other, acted kindly, then aggrieved, seemed like the nursing home. We spoke to my great-grandmother. 6 years later, she left us. In time, my mother left me, once by running off with a man, later by dying. As life goes, the knitting together and the unraveling, this isn't unusual or tragic. It's ordinary, but mysterious. It happens to you.
Deborah Monroe is the author of 6 books, including the memoir My Unsentimental Education. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton.
Now, a new mini-camp focusing on carpentry will be opening up at the Madison College this summer. The camp has a focus on one group in particular, girls between the ages of 13 and 15. Here to tell us more about it is Sandy Thistle, carpentry instructor at Madison College. Sandy, thanks for joining us today.
Good afternoon.
Well, Sandy, why carpentry? Why teenage girls?
Carpentry because I have been a carpenter for 27 years, and work primarily in commercial construction. I now teach carpentry at Madison Area Technical College. And in reflecting on how I got here and exposure as a young woman, recognizing a void of opportunity for girls even still to use power tools, and wanting to get more women into the skilled trades.
Yeah, why is it? Why don't girls get exposed to carpentry and other trades like that at an early age?
I think actually less and less people get exposed to it overall. And traditionally, young men in a family, if they had a family member who did construction, it might be the sort of thing that they would hang out on a job site in their younger years and do things like manual labor, hauling block or something like that. And I recall that when I was a young woman, I would attempt to help and be told things like, oh, girls can't do that, which the stubborn part of me is like my whole life proving that girls can do anything.
Is this going to be the first time you do this camp?
Yes, it is. I've had the idea for this camp for a number of years. And about 3 years ago, I volunteered with Camp Hero, which focuses on girls in protective services occupations, firefighting, police service, and EMTs. And at that point, really had a vision that I wanted to offer a similar sort of a thing for girls and power tools. And I have two teenage daughters, and one of the ideas that I've had for them, or my visions for them, is that they would leave my home being comfortable with power tools, because these are essential skill for people.
And what kind of response have you gotten so far?
Well, the word about it is just starting to come out, and it's funny, the things I have heard have been through social media from a lot of adult women saying, wow, are you going to teach this for women?
You already do, though, right?
Yes, we do.
Or for grown-ups in general.
Yes.
We're talking to Sandy Thistle, carpentry instructor at Madison College, a new camp starting up this summer for girls between the ages of 13 and 15, teaching them carpentry and the use of power tools. Well, tell us your story a little more, Sandy. You mentioned how you were dissuaded from participating in some of these trade-type activities. How did you get started?
It was sort of by accident. Going to the UW-Madison, not quite sure what I wanted to do as an academically successful young woman in high school. I was steered toward nursing or teaching. And funny that I've come all the way around and I'm teaching now. And I went to the UW because that's what was expected. And really, nursing wasn't the fit for me, and that it was what I chose. And in the meantime, I had the opportunity to do some hands-on projects like painting a house and some other things like that. And then I had a friend start a carpentry apprenticeship a year before I started my apprenticeship, and I saw the joy. I saw her on a regular basis. She was really happy. She was kind of an outdoorsy gal, physically active, and really happy switching from an academic area to hands-on trade. And I thought, oh, I'll give that a go, and if I don't like it, I'll quit. And here it is 27 years later, and I can say that I still love what I do. I love carpentry.
I wonder, I mean, you heard at an early age, girls can't do this. Now you do this. As a woman, do you still get the sense or even the flat-out statement? What's a woman doing this job?
Here at Madison College, in terms of my colleagues, we are a great team together, and uniquely, our team of four full-time faculty members, three of us are women. So maybe you should ask that question of the man that I work with. And out in the field, in the beginning, it was more of a thing, but as I gained skill and expertise, my skill and expertise sort of spoke for me, and people were a little less hesitant to have me work on their crew when they could see what I was useful for, you know, that I could do the work and handle myself.
Now, Sandy, I bet there's a lot of people listening, men and women of a variety of ages, thinking, I wish I had done something like this, maybe not as a trade necessarily, but as a hobby. What's your recommendation? What's a good way for people to start at any age learning carpentry skills?
Well, there are a few options. I'm going to focus on the one for women for a moment. The college has a non-traditional occupations area, and that area offers workshops for women interested in exploring non-traditional jobs. And one of those areas are carpentry-related jobs and construction jobs. So if a woman is interested in this as a career, it gives her a chance to try some of the skills, use some of the tools, and see if it's a good fit and if she's interested in pursuing it further. For both genders, there are nighttime classes, mostly focused on woodworking sorts of skills. And our program a year ago, expanded to offer what we call the construction bridge. And it is for those folks who have day jobs, who might be interested in a career change to learn carpentry skills. And we've had some what I would call hobbyists start in those classes because there have been a few openings. And a few of them have switched to trying to develop a career change because they like the work so much.
And we'll leave it there for now. Sandy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Sandy Thistle, carpentry instructor at Madison College. She talked to us about a new summer camp there on carpentry for teenage girls.
Coming up, we'll talk to a former porn addict about the negative consequences of pornography for adolescent boys. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up tonight at 7, hear intriguing stories about the defining moments in people's lives on this week's edition of Snap Judgment. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, for the next half hour, we'll be using some sexual terms and descriptions. So listener discretion is advised, especially if you're with your young ones. Yesterday, Utah Governor Gary Herbert signed a resolution declaring pornography to be a public health crisis. The resolution called for more education and prevention to keep hardcore pornography away from children.
Our next guest has a similar viewpoint. He's not anti-porn, but he's working to raise awareness of some of the negative consequences of pornography, especially for young people. Gabe Deem is a former porn addict and the founder of RebootNation.org. He's an activist for better sex education. Gabe, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
So, Gabe, let's start with your personal story. How old were you when you first discovered pornography on the internet?
Well, I was first exposed to pornographic images at around the age of 8 with Hustler or Playboy magazine. But internet porn didn't come into the picture until I was 12. And that was around 1999 when my family got high-speed internet.
So how accessible was porn when you were younger? I mean, you had high-speed internet, but that doesn't necessarily mean that porn was easy to get. But was it easy to get?
Right. Yeah, it was actually extremely easy to get. My buddies and I at school would actually pass pieces of paper back and forth with websites. And back then it was file-sharing sites like Napster, LimeWire, Kazaa, where you could download as many videos as you wanted to, and we would give each other tips on how to hide it and clear our history. So it was surprisingly very easy to access, even back, 15, 16 years ago.
And would you say that easy access is the same today or maybe even easier?
Oh, it's a lot easier today. If you have social media or a smartphone, you can just go on there and type something in, and within seconds you can see whatever you want. And really the game changer happened around 2005, and that's when YouTube was created. And shortly after that, you had an explosion of porn tube sites that mimic YouTube, where you can have multiple videos streaming at the same time in different tabs. And you can always search and search for more instantly.
I think that for a fair amount of people, the concept of free porn online is very foreign. There's a sense that you have to pay for what you get. And so as long as a kid doesn't have access to, say, a credit card, that there's not a risk. But that's not what you're saying, is it?
No, that's not what I'm saying at all. It's definitely a risk. If you have internet access, any computer savvy kid can get around blocks or find ways to watch adult content. It's not that hard to get around and find.
So, Gabe, when did you first realize that you had a problem with watching internet porn?
Well, for me personally, my porn use was very consistent all through my adolescence, and that's what you'll see is very common in us younger guys that are giving up porn. I didn't realize I had a problem until I was 23 years old, and I got with an attractive partner, someone I really cared about, and I found beautiful and attractive, yet my body couldn't function. And so I went online and searched, I Googled like anyone would do, and I found forums and threads with thousands of guys with the same problem. They had used internet porn for years, and eventually got to the point where they were dependent on porn for arousal and sexual function.
And so what you're referring to is considered to be porn-induced erectile dysfunction.
Right, yeah. We wire our arousal template in our brain and condition ourselves to the point where we are dependent on the novelty that internet porn provides to feel arousal and to function, yeah.
And so you said that you were a regular user of internet porn. What kind of frequency, say how many hours a day would you say you were watching internet porn?
Right, so there's a misconception of a porn addict. It's not necessarily the duration of time you're watching porn, and it has more to do with the novelty and the shock. So for my my example, I'd say 15 to 30 minutes, no more than an hour a day. But what happened in my case was I escalated into more shocking genres, and I also escalated into needing compilation videos, almost like a highlight tape where the scene changes every 2 seconds to the most shocking parts of porn movies. And that's one of the ways guys can escalate once you become addicted or desensitized.
We're talking with Gabe Diem. He's a former porn addict and the founder of RebootNation.org. He's sharing his personal story of being addicted to porn and how it affected him in trying to have healthy relationships in real life. And he's also an activist for better sex education. So, Gabe, you say that there's a way to know if you are addicted to porn, if it is affecting how you can perform in real life. What is that test?
Right. There's a simple test you can do. A young, healthy man should be able to get an erection on his own, to masturbate on his own without being dependent on pixels on a screen, without needing porn. The reason this rules a lot of things out is because if you can still function with porn, then you know you don't have an organic problem, because simply turning on porn doesn't magically make organic problems disappear. And then also, if you're unable to masturbate without porn, that rules out performance anxiety, which is commonly, you know, told to young guys, oh, it's all in your head, just get some Viagra and you'll be okay. But that rules out performance anxiety if you can't masturbate without porn, because you're not nervous when it's just you and your hand. So that's the simple test that I did back when I was 23, about 5 years ago. And that's when I really opened my eyes, like, oh my gosh, I'm dependent on this to function and I shouldn't be.
And so what was that like for you, realizing that you had developed this dependency when you thought you were just, you know, taking part in something that was kind of a normal part of adolescence?
Well, it was, a whirlwind of emotions. I was frustrated. I was pretty upset that I had no clue that this could even be a possibility. And not only that, but kicking the addiction and habit, if you will, it was tough. I went through anxiety and stress and, you know, borderline insomnia. When you kick a behavioral addiction, usually you see an increase in stress and anxiety, and I experienced that. And normally I'm a pretty laid-back guy. But going through those first couple months, it was rough. I was depressed, and I didn't think I was going to ever recover. You know, when you're in your early 20s, you should be at the prime of your life, energy-wise and function-wise, and not being able to function was, you know, a kick in the gut. So it was tough. It was difficult. But the good news is I learned that you could recover, and I saw other people's success stories, which gave me a lot of hope.
So, Gabe, once you had quit porn, and did you quit completely, or did you cut back, or did you only look at, have one tab open, as you were saying, you know, having multiple tabs open? I mean, did you basically go cold turkey?
Yes, I did. As soon as I realized what my porn use had done to me, I decided for myself that I was done with it for good. It wasn't easy, but that was my route to recovery, was to stop, you know, reinforcing that behavior that led to my condition.
And so when you did quit porn, you said the recovery period was difficult, but when you kind of got to the other side, what specific benefits did you see?
Yeah, so the benefits are all over the table, and they're pretty awesome. For me personally, it was increased motivation, you know, the ability to feel emotional situations again and to feel intimacy and to actually connect with my partner. And, you know, the ability to function came back after several months. And that was obviously the most important driver for me in the beginning, was just to get my function back. But all the other benefits, like mental clarity and increased motivation and just feeling connected to real people again, that was, you know, in the end, the most beautiful part to me. You know, guys might quit, obviously, for the function reason, but we really, you know, when we come out of it, we really understand how much we've been missing out on being so plugged into pixels and disconnected from real life.
We're talking to former porn addict Gabe Deem about why he's trying to raise awareness of the negative consequences of pornography, especially for younger viewers, and we'll be getting into more of the science as well.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you're a parent, how do you talk to your kids about sex, and how do you help them navigate our sexualized culture? What do you say to them about pornography? How do you deal with this unrestricted access to online pornography? Have you been through an experience yourself similar to Gabe's? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're picking up our discussion now about the negative consequences of pornography. Just a reminder, we're talking about a sensitive topic that might not be suitable for very young listeners.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a parent, what do you do in your home to try to restrict your child's access to pornography? How important do you think it is to limit access to sexual content on the internet? How do you talk to your kids about sex and porn? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Gabe Deem is a former porn addict and the founder of RebootNation.org. He's an activist for better sex education. And Gabe, so let's talk a little about the science. You make a distinction of when you were exposed to static images, like in a magazine, versus the internet porn that you became addicted to. What does science say about why internet porn, why those video images are such an attractive stimulus for the human brain?
Right. So I think the biggest driving factor would be the novelty that internet porn provides. There's a phenomenon called the Coolidge effect, which is describing a neurological mechanism in our brains that basically can override habituation, or to put simply, when we become bored. And it does this by, you know, our brain's natural response to novel or new sexual stimulation. And this is what the internet and internet porn specifically can tap into, with the ability to click and click and click and always escalate into something more shocking or new. And if you're a heavy porn user, a lot of guys talk about how, you know, they search and search for the quote-unquote perfect scene to finish to. And that is very common with my generation and teenagers, is we're so used to being able to surf the net when we watch porn that the novelty is endless. So we can keep stimulation in our brains up for higher and longer than, you know, that's ever been possible in human history.
But clearly that is not... you can't replicate that in real life with a real partner. So,
right. So
there's this disconnect then in what you've trained your brain to expect and what's in front of you.
Right. Yeah. There's several addiction-related brain changes that can happen. Sensitization is one, which is just a fancy word for a powerful memory or Pavlov's dog-like conditioning, where you have cravings and compulsion to use a certain stimulus that you've been using. So if you chronically consume internet porn all through your adolescence, you're basically teaching and learning that that's where your sexual arousal and your sex drive is going to come from and go. And if you do that, you know, consistently over a long period of time, eventually it can lead to the dependency on that stimulus to function.
Let's go to the phones, and Anna is calling from Wisconsin. Hi, Anna.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I just want to say I'm just really glad that Gabe is talking about this, and that we're talking about porn as an addiction. So often it's seen as quote-unquote normal among men, teenagers, young guys. My husband is a addict, and he recognizes that and is getting help as a sponsor and goes to Sex Addicts Anonymous, and that's a really big pillar in his life. But it's so hard, and there is so much shame associated, and especially with, like I said, it just being so mainstream and so common.
Thanks for that call, Anna. And Gabe, there's actually some disagreement in the psychological community about whether porn addiction exists, right?
Yeah, there's a couple vocal naysayers. They are the minority from what I've seen as far as the neuroscientists that are studying this. There are now 20-plus neuroscience brain studies, or 10 brain scan studies and 20-plus neuropsychological studies that all show evidence for addiction-related brain changes that have been done on porn users. And even they do disagree, and there's been a lot of reviews on certain researchers' interpretations of their findings. And they all point to the possibility of addiction being a real thing and porn addiction being a real thing from what I've seen. But there are some vocal naysayers, yes.
Thanks for that call, Anna. And let's go to Teresa in Wisconsin now. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. I had two things. One, my ex-husband is addicted to porn, and I have a 16-year-old son who's over there all the time, and I'm just scared to death that he's going to get exposed to it. So I would like to ask your guest, what's the best thing I can do to try and prevent that? And number two, there seems to be a lot of money going that direction, and my son is realizing that his father never has money, even though he gets a paycheck every 2 weeks, and he's wondering where all that money goes.
Thanks for that call, Teresa. And Gabe, what would you advise Teresa as the mother of a 16-year-old son that she's concerned about?
Well, I think you got to break it into two parts. One part being obviously teach your child that porn is not how real sexual intimacy occurs. I think that's the first thing. And then the second thing that I think is very important is the brain science, the neuroscience. And a great website to send your teenager to is a site called yourbrainonporn.com. It has lots of informational videos and articles explaining what happens in your brain and explains the reasoning behind the potential negative effects. And I think what was most important for me is just learning what I was doing to myself and what I need to do to stop it and recover was a very eye-opening experience for me. And as a man, you know, I really want to know how things function, especially my own body. So learning that was very important for me. And it had nothing to do with morals or this is good and bad or anything to get a teenager to go, oh, gosh, whatever. It was just very informational. And I think that's what connects with the kids.
Thanks for that call, Teresa. And Gabe, we're talking about having those conversations with children, with young people. I have to say it's hard enough for a lot of parents to have pretty much the most basic sex talk with their kids, let alone even bringing up the topic of pornography. But it sounds like you think it's a pretty important thing to cover.
Yes, absolutely. You know, you'll get different opinions from everyone on what age you should start that conversation. But we know now from several studies and surveys that the average exposure is 11 years old now. And I would actually argue it's probably younger than that with a majority of kids getting smartphones now. So I think, you know, you need to have a conversation around it, I'd say at 8. or depending on what your parental preference is, not too long after that. And again, you don't have to go straight to the porn talk. I think you can teach a kid what healthy intimacy will look like when they grow up, and then you can get into how the brain works and how it wires up to what you see and what you experience. And then as they get a little older and understand more fancy scientific concepts, you can teach them, you know, what's happening in their brain. But I think as young as possible is the best.
and also, like, school-based sex ed is a pretty, you know, hot-button political issue at times. Is this something you think should be addressed outside of the home in, say, a classroom sex ed class?
Yes, I personally do. I don't think you have to get outside of biological, anatomical, and physiological facts, but I do think that the kids need to be learning about the most important sex organ, which to me is the brain.
And Gabe, what would you say to someone who is currently struggling with a porn addiction now? What would you offer them as someone who has come through on the other side?
Well, you know, there's help out there for them. My step one that I give guys is get educated, learn the science behind what's going on. Step two is get support, join a free online community like the one on my site, or there's several other sites out there. And then there's lots of informational articles and videos on a site like yourbrainonporn.com. And I've myself have made several YouTube videos. If you search Reboot Nation, I got lots of helpful videos just for guys that are getting started, and for women too, because this science applies to women too. It's just not as mainstream talked about, unfortunately. But yes, anyone with an addiction can get help out there.
Well, Gabe Deem, thanks so much for joining us today and for sharing your own story.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I think it's an important topic, and I'm glad you guys are covering it.
Thank you. That was Gabe Deem, former porn addict and the founder of RebootNation.org. He's an activist for better sex education, and he joined us to share his personal story about addiction to porn and to talk about the negative consequences of pornography.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.